Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
And this is Darren Dockerman.
And if you haven't already made the trek, it's time to join us on our Kickstarter. The Trekspurts are getting ready to go to all the great Star Trek locations around the globe and perhaps around the galaxy.
We'll be boldly going, not just, you know, weekly going. It's bold.
Indeed, it is, Darren. And we've announced some wonderful people will be taking the trek with us. Just recently, the lovely and talented Terry Farrell, you know her as Dax from Deep Space Nine. She's going to be joining the trek. And when we head up old Star Trek Five-Way, Trona Peaks, Cynthia Gao is on board, Caitlin Dar, to mediate galactic peace between the three of us. Because, you know, Darren and Ashley and I don't always get along, but when we have someone to mediate galactic peace, we're in a much better place.
I suppose that's Klingon for yippee.
And there are some spectacular backer rewards, everything from challenge coins to pins to a chance to actually join us on the podcast, as well as Ernie the Vasquez Rock. And that's my favorite. So I think you should hop on that right away. And if you want to support our Kickstarter, you can go to makethetrek.com. That's makethetrek.com today and grow stronger through the sharing. You'll be glad you did. We look forward to you joining us on this incredible adventure.
Join us.
Yeehaw! The Trekspurts Inglorious live tour continues this summer as we head to Austin, Texas, for another great GalaxyCon. Right, Darren?
The home of Steve Austin. No, it's not the home of Steve Austin. It's the home of fun and galaxy goodness.
We're going to go galaxy hopping. We're hopping galaxies. We're hopping galaxies. We're not the only ones who are hopping galaxies. Angel himself, David Boreanaz, is going to be there. Andy Serkis, the chameleon. Maybe he'll break free. Maybe he'll be able to escape from Austin by the end of the weekend. Charlie Cox, the daredevil himself, Vincent D'Onofrio. Ming-Na Wen, the wonderful, luminous Ming-Na Wen, star of Book of Boba Fett, is going to be there. Stephen Amell. Let's see if he fails this city. And many more, including such Trek luminaries as Bill Shatner, Walter Koenig, LeVar Burton, Jonathan Frakes, Gates McFadden, Armin Shirman, the great and luminous Terry Farrell, Will Wheaton, and many more, including our good friend Terry Metalis, the showrunner of Star Trek Picard Season 3, and everybody's favorite Giancarlo Esposito. We all love Giancarlo, so
more that is pretty cool. More stars than they're in the sky.
I know, more stars than there are in the galaxy, in fact, at GalaxyCon. So we're going to be thrilled to be there. The Trekspurts will be moderating another couple of fantastic panels. We hope you'll join us. It's always a great time at GalaxyCon. You can find out more at GalaxyCon.com. That's GalaxyCon.com. And join us in Austin, Texas, September 1st through September 3rd. It'll be a great Labor Day. Love's Labor Lost.
See you there, partner.
Yeehaw!
Hey, this is Mark Altman of Inglourious Trekspurts in the 430 movie. And if you're a fan of our podcast, you don't want to miss Deck 78, available now by subscribing at trekspurtsplus.com. This is a bonus podcast full of great discussions about popular culture, film, and television. By your command, here's a sneak peek.
He's a different kind of hero. And if you put it in the context of when this show was at its peak in the late 50s. That's sort of the peak of cowboys and Indians on TV. And kids played cowboys and Indians all the time. It's before the 1960s, so you didn't have monster kids yet. You didn't have sci-fi kids yet. It was all about Westerns and playing cowboys and Indians. And that's why Disneyland has a whole frontier section for that very same reason.
He wasn't Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett.
No, he's different.
Because, Scott, he's quoting Shakespeare and Dickens.
Right.
I mean, it's more Star Trek II.
Right.
He's so erudite. And one of the great episodes, I know Doug Drexler talks about this a lot, is Molly Maguire, I think, he gets robbed, and so he has no money, no anything, and he gets a job working for this woman, on her ranch, and she doesn't know who he is, but he can cook and he can clean, and she thinks he's amazing, but then she notices the calluses on his hand, and she hates violence because her husband was killed in a gunfight. But, you know, ultimately, he goes to our library and starts quoting all these books, and she just can't believe this guy. Like, he's truly a Renaissance man. Yeah. And that's why there's that Spock quality, and there's also the McCoy hatred of injustice. And it's amazing, isn't it? Wouldn't you say, Scott?
Yeah, one of the Roddenberry episodes, one of the first ones that Roddenberry wrote for the show, has him kind of like rolling up on this fort right on the frontier with the various tribes. And he rolls up with some Indian friends, and they're already start shooting. And the way he just comes down and like handles it, and he's like, I'm going to be very nice. I'm going to talk to everybody. I think he throws out some quotes to the guys at the fort. But then whenever it's clear that no one's going to listen, he turns, and the Indians are like, all right, we trust Powell, and we don't trust them, and they all bail. Yeah. And then that whole episode has him with this crooked fort commander tracking down Indian gold.
Yeah.
And again, you'll see him dropping good quotes of this. And what struck me also about it is Powell is very much, no, this is the law. They have a right to their gold. And it brought to mind all the prime directive issues.
Oh, exactly. Totally.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's not just a gunfighter. He's a fixer. He's a problem solver.
So subscribe today at treksfirstplus.com and don't miss a single episode of Deck 78. Fire the rockets.
Hey, this is Mark A. Altman.
And this is Darren Dockerman.
And this is Ashley Miller.
And we are the Inglorious
Treksperts. And we're back. And this week we have a very special guest with us. It's the very talented and delightful Armin Shimerman.
Quark, we have an entire episode in iambic pentameter.
That's right. Well, occasionally in blank verse, but that's
just blank stares.
Now, unfortunately, Armin Shimerman can't talk about Deep Space Nine, so he'll be talking about the Buck Henry series Quark instead.
Yes, that was a lovely joke that he absolutely didn't want to participate in.
But you remember that show, Quark, with Richard Benjamin?
Yeah, of course.
Man, you loved it, didn't you?
For a while there, I thought it was the greatest science fiction show ever made.
No doubt you did.
The twins.
About a trash man twins. In outer space.
The twins. There are no twins on Star Trek. I was like, you know, this is kind of an upgrade.
Of course,
but
there
Tim
were twins.
Thomerson
on Star Trek.
Was ahead of his time. Didn't he play trans? Wasn't he trans in that show? Thomerson? Didn't he play a woman and a man? And
I don't know.
This is not Quark.
I don't know.
Anyway, we don't care about Quark. We're going to talk about the real Quark, the Quark we know and love, Armin Shimerman.
Quark we trust.
And obviously, this is a challenging. This theoretically was a challenging panel because, of course, this panel took place several days after the Screen Actors Guilds went on strike. And, of course, they had very stringent rules about what their actors could talk about during convention appearances. So talking about any series that you were on was strictly verboten. But we, rather than look at that as a problem, looked at it as a challenge and as a fun. And what was great was we were able to talk about his animated shows, his video games, and most of all, talk about his experience doing teaching Shakespeare. And I think that is really a wonderful thing that we explored. And you'll see as we're joined at GalaxyCon Raleigh by the great Armin Shimerman. So sit back and enjoy our conversation with Armin Shimerman.
Hey guys, welcome. We're so excited to be here in North Carolina. We got a great guest. I'm Mark Altman of Inglorious Treksperts and Pandora and Librarians and a bunch of other stuff. And I want to introduce you to my partners in crime on the podcast. Of course, you know him as the associate producer and visual effects supervisor on Star Trek The Motion Picture Director's Edition and a concept artist in Hollywood, Darren Dockerman. And the writer of Thor and X-Men First Class, the showrunner in Dota, Dragon's Blood, Ashley Edward Miller. But the reason we're all here, I've known this man for a long time. I can't say on where we met because, as you know, both the Writers Guild and SAG are on strike. We're going to talk a little bit about that and hope we can count on your support in the months to come, which it does feel like it's going to be the months to come. And without any further ado, I want to introduce you to the great Armin Shimerman.
Thank you all. Thank you. So what are we going to talk about?
We got a lot. You know, you may not remember this. Years ago, there was a convention for another convention company. I won't mention it. And you were snowed in. You couldn't come to the convention.
Oh, yeah.
And I was running this for the boys back in the day. And we said, let's do it by phone. And you called in. And it was like this really memorable thing for everybody. It was like, wow, you know, Armin couldn't be there, but we did it by phone. This had never happened before. This is long before Zoom.
It's like the golden age of radio.
It was like, exactly.
I'm a terrific voiceover actor.
And you signed autograph for everybody remotely, and everyone in the crowd got sent by Gary and Adam. But today, this is...
Yeah, really, my wife still has a sore hand from all those autographs.
This is such a great opportunity to talk to Armin about the things... You know when you see on iTunes, they have like the top 40 and then they have deep cuts, right? Today we do the deep cuts, right? Which is great because we're going to talk about things that maybe you haven't heard Armin talk about in the past that wasn't, in Starlog. So we're thrilled because you've done so many things in your career. And I think that obviously for this audience, you're probably very well acquainted with Armin's very extensive voiceover and video game credits. I want to ask you, so who were you in Reservoir Dogs, the video game? Mr. Tangerine or Mr. Tangerine Man?
I have so many credits, I don't remember that one at all. I don't remember, Mark.
No, but obviously many more credits to your, that are far more...
I think IMDb says I have 212 credits.
Oh, is that all? Oh.
But Renee had 230. Oh. So, you know.
I didn't realize you were so competitive.
With Renee? Never. Never.
Play to listen.
Never.
But I mean, he worked with Robert Altman, so.
Yeah, exactly. Which he mentioned often.
So tell us about how liberating voiceover work is.
Oh, it's incredible. I'm sorry to jump to that, but it is. No makeup. No lines to memorize, no blocking. If you're doing a cartoon show, you're involved in the booth with wonderful, incredible people. In fact, two of the most incredible voiceover actors I ever worked with will be here at this convention, Frank Welker and Richard Horvitz, who, if they're not here today, you should definitely meet them. They are wonderful people. Frank Welker is amazing. The things I watched him do, I just stood there with my mouth wide open. Anyway, to answer your question, it's very liberating. And because nobody can see what you're doing, you can go way over the top, way, way over the top. For instance, some of you may or may not know me from the game Ratchet and Clank. Where when I do that, I'm going to drop the microphone down so I don't blast everybody. But everybody, you know, I talk like this at the top of my voice. It doesn't sound that wonderful, but when you have wonderful writers, it comes out very well. But you do get a chance to do it three different ways. At least that's what usual the process is. They say to me, Armin, can you read this line three different ways? And then the first time you sort of get it right. The second time you go, oh, now I know what this means. And the third time is usually the one they print because that's the one that has some artistry to it. But it is a great and wonderful experience. It also, I'm a character actor. I don't get to play a lot of roles because of the way I look. And that's okay. I'm okay with that. But in voiceovers, you can play things that you would never be cast on in on camera. For instance, this may be a surprise to you, but in one of the cartoons, it's hard to believe, I played Superman. I mean, they would never give me that.
Well, James Gunn could be going in a different direction.
It could. I did a wonderful game called BioShock.
Yeah.
And I played the character of Andrew Ryan, which they're making a film of. I called my agent up and I said, listen, I know they're not going to give me Andrew Ryan. That's very clear. But if I could just get some sort of a cameo part where, you know, I just showed up, that would be lovely. But there are parts you can't play on camera because of the way you look. But voiceovers, you can do anything.
if you have the voice for it and the talent for it.
Can you talk a little bit about the different style of acting for microphone?
Sure.
Because you have to, you know, give it some voice effort to make movements of the characters seem more real.
Absolutely. You have to walk a fine line of being slightly over the top but real at the same time. And that's, I think, why they ask you to do three, so that they get one that's on that mark.
Right.
It is a little over the top because you have to give it energy, but you can't be, it can't be way over the top unless you're doing nefarious. But yeah, it's a fine line. It's a lovely line to walk, actually.
Was that difficult for you the first time that you did that? Because, you know,
overacting is not hard for me.
Well, you know, I've worked with some actors who came from live action, got into the booth, and, you know, number one, they tried to go off book. God bless them. And they didn't realize that the way that they needed to work would be different. They were very concerned about being too big.
Yeah, a lot of actors, you know, somewhere around the 1980s, actors realized that their performances were better if they just spoke down here all the time, and so that the sound man can barely hear you, and because that performance has to intrinsically be more real because you're not acting, you're just talking very quietly. So actors have been indoctrinated into thinking that's the best quality work. The truth of the matter is that can be indeed very good quality work, but so can over-the-top acting or anywhere in between, as long as it matches, so that the performance matches the concept of what the writers came up with originally. You can bring new things to material. That's what we do. We are not the original creators. We are the interpretive artists. We take what's given to us, we interpret it, and hopefully give it some new facets. But the level of performance is dependent, again, upon the character that was written.
Yep. Many people in this room are probably familiar with that famous YouTube clip of Shatner berating the technician who says, who's telling him how to say sabotage. And he says, don't tell me how to do it. It sickens me. And I just wonder if how different it is doing, say, a video game from an animated series. But animated series, often you're dealing with a director or a showrunner. You mentioned giving them three and being done. Is it different with video games where you don't get that kind of
direction? No, actually, it's the other way around. Video games is where they ask you to do three. In cartoons and animated shows, we'll do it. Again, if it's a cartoon like the one I did for years called Grim and Evil, where we were all in the room together, Frank and I and Richard and Lyle Gray were all in the room together, and we bounced off of each other. So in a sense, it's like a theater. Video games is you're all by yourself. I was just saying to one of the people who came to my table, I've been doing Ratchet and Clank for 15, 18 years, and only twice have I ever met Ratchet and Clank. I've never met the actors who perform them. I met James and David once, or maybe twice. So in games, yes, you do three. In cartoons and animation, you do the performance, and then the director will get on the god mic and say a little bit more, a little bit less. Like, for instance, this is just memorable to me. Frank Welker, who I mentioned before, we were doing Grim and Evil. The director needed the voice of a porpoise.
As you do.
And as they do, exactly, as they do. And Frank gave them a voice of a porpoise, which was amazing. Then the director, Chris, got on the horn and said, Frank, can you do a younger porpoise? And he did.
Yeah, of course.
And then she said to him, I was wrong. I really need an older porpoise. And he did. And my mouth was on the floor. I couldn't believe what he had just done. So that's how that works. It depends on the taste of the director and the original taste of the actress, because we do the original reading. But then the director can tweak it a little so she gets what's closer to what she thinks the producers and directors want.
Not that this ever happens, but have you ever had a bad director?
Um,
Even on a show you can't talk about?
Not on that show. But I have been on some other shows where I don't know if it was the director or just in toto, it was just a bad experience. A bad director. I did have a bad director once on a Broadway show. I was doing a Broadway show. Does any of you all too young to remember Richard Rodgers? Anybody remember Richard Rodgers? So the last show that Richard Rodgers did was a show, I can talk about theater, see?
Yeah. Different union.
Richard Rodgers did a show called I Remember Mama, starring Lee Vollman and myself. And that director was just horrible and asked me to do things that I tried. I'm a dutiful person, as Avery Brooks once said. You're too dutiful. Can I say that? Yeah, I can say that.
We don't know where he told you that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And the director just was giving me bad directions. And I would try it once or twice. And then I would realize from the sound of the audience that it wasn't working. And so I would just change. And then he would tell me, you're not doing what I told you. And I went, that's right. Yeah. So, yes, it's easier to point out a bad director in the theater because you spend more time with them.
Right.
And I'm sure if Renee was here, he would point out he did 5 Broadway shows. But
he would, and I did 4. He did 5, but his parts were bigger than mine, I'm sure. He was a fun... Just for a moment, I certainly beloved... I loved Renee. And I miss him every day. I have pictures of him all around the house. But Renee on stage was a god. Yeah. You know, forget John DeLancey. John's good, but he's no god. He's no god. But Renee was a god. And he, when I realized that I had to work with him, I was intimidated. Because he is a god. He was a god on stage. He did things that just were impossible. He just did incredible things. And it was always a great pleasure and a great nuisance to work with Mr. Auberginois.
Well, I want to ask you, you mentioned theater. Mm-hmm. You have been very active in the theater, both with your own theater company, but also teaching Shakespeare professionally. And have you found that the audiences for Shakespeare have changed, or the way you approach teaching Shakespeare has changed generationally?
I actually haven't changed my approach to teaching Shakespeare, although as I learn more, that gets incorporated. As I learn more, I pass it on to my students. But I think Shakespeare has become a little more Marvel than Marvel movies than it used to be. I think directors are a little frightened of trusting the language. The language I know can be hard to understand. That's not the playwright's fault. That's bad acting. What I teach actors to do is to make that language as clear as it possibly can be, and it can be exponentially clearer to an audience than it normally is because actors have a tendency... and directors primarily to do things that overshadow the language, is so they don't trust the language, and that they want to do something to make you think something else or to hear something else, and you're that causes the audience to be convoluted because what they're hearing and what they're seeing don't often match.
Right,
and that's a problem for audiences. If you do Shakespeare correctly, I think it's relatively easy to understand. And I'm just dickering with myself for a moment here. I haven't done this for years. Okay.
He is Superman.
One of the first Shakespearean plays I ever did was with Chris Reeve.
Wow.
Well, say there is no kingdom then for Richard. What other pleasures can the world afford? I'll make my heaven in a lady's lap, and get my body in gay ornaments, and which sweet lady with my words and looks. Love forswore me in my mother's womb. She did corrupt frail nature with some bribe to shrink mine arm up like a withered shrub, to put an envious mountain on my back where sits deformity to wreck my soul, to shape my legs of an unequal size, to disproportion me in every part like to a chaos. And am I then a man to be beloved? Ah! Then, since this earth affords no joy to me, I'll make my heaven to dream upon the crown. And yet, I know not how to get the crown, for many lives stand between me and home. Why, I can smile and murder whilst I smile, and cry content to that which grieves my heart. I can add colors to the chameleon, change shapes with Proteus for advantages, and set the murderous Machiavel to school. Can I do this? Cannot get a crown? Tut. Were it further off, I will pluck it down.
And that should have used up about 20 minutes. and by the way, most of the people from that science fiction show that I'm connected with have all backgrounds like that. They're all classically trained actors that went through a lot of study, a lot of experience to eventually get cast in roles where they could use their talents, their experience, their knowledge to create the characters that a lot of us are in love with.
It's great watching you there. It made me realize I didn't even need to see Richard the First or Second to understand what you were doing.
Just the sequel, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Richard the Third is the one where they destroy the Enterprise?
That's the one.
Okay. When you start to teach Shakespeare that first day when your class, you know, and I imagine you're not very Kingsfieldian, you're a little more accessible to the audience, to your students. What is the way, what do you offer them? Because a lot, you know, most people I think in that class embrace it. They're there for a reason. But other people, like you said, they may be alienated by the language or they think, oh, this is, you know, this is a what a boomer. Hey, boomer! Right. You know, it's like that Shakespeare is so old; it has nothing to say to us today. And of course, that's could not be more far from the truth. So, what's your introduction to Shakespeare to the class?
Thank you, Mark. That's a good question. So, the first thing I say is, I'm about to teach you not a new language, but a new way to approach language. Shakespeare is not Old English. I hear that said sometimes. Oh, it's an Old English. It's not an Old English. You want to hear Old English? When that opera with Ishura, Suta, the Druchtemar, Chepersa to the Ruta, and every vein in switch the core of which vertu, Agendura, that's Old English.
Yeah.
it's modern English, but what actors, directors don't understand is Shakespeare and his contemporaries were taught a particular way to look at language, and that's through Greek rhetoric, the study of rhetoric. And if you can, what I do is I begin to show the actors what are the rhetorical, what they're called figures, the rhetorical figures in the language that will make it more understandable to an audience? I'm going to teach class now. Are you ready? This is free, by the way. I don't know why, but
you know, never give yourself away for free. But yeah. Okay.
So the first thing I tell them is that in Shakespeare, one of the great figures in rhetoric is something called antithesis, opposites. The great famous antithesis in Shakespeare is to be or not to be. So when you're performing, I say to my students, you cannot say to be or not to be, that is the question, because that doesn't follow the rhetorical rules. If you're a Hamlet that wants to die, then the not to be part of the equation is the much more important part of the equation between the two. So it becomes to be or not to be. That is the question. So that we get the tension between to be or not to be. If it's the other way around, if it's a Hamlet who wants to live, then the other part of the equation becomes predominant. And then it becomes to be or not to be. That is the question. But there's the tension is still there. The choice is up to the actor which way they want to go. And what happens is in Shakespeare, there's constant antithesis, or what I call also juxtaposition, where two things are not necessarily opposite, but they are being juxtaposed one against the other. Once an actor begins to do that, to make what actors call specifics, which is simply making a word sound like what you think it means, then the language becomes, as I said before, infinitesimally clearer. So that's how I approach it.
So it's basically, it's about getting beyond the language, the words on the page, and finding a way to internalize that.
In a sense, we don't get beyond. What we do is we spell out, without overacting, we spell out what the words mean. As what I always say to my students is, you have to know what every word means, and not just the definition, but the context of the meaning. Because if you don't understand it, is the audience going to understand it if you don't understand it? So I make them do their homework over and over again, looking and looking at the meaning of words. I'm sorry to take up your time. I know this isn't wanted to go.
This is why we're here.
It's your time, not our time.
For instance, there's a very famous quote that many of you, from Romeo and Juliet. What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east and Juliet is the sun. Everybody knows that. But most people don't know what that means. We know the line. What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east and Juliet is the sun. Now, I ask my class on a regular basis, I give them this sort of verbal oral test. What does it mean? What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east and Juliet is the sun. Juliet, we know, is off stage. Well, all we're getting is some candlelight coming through a window. The antithesis or the juxtaposition here is between the words east and sun. Now, why are they antithetical? Because for Shakespeare and his followers and the people who went to the audience, and probably for most of you here, for those of you who used to wake up when I used to wake up to get that makeup on that show I can't pronounce, the sun comes up in the east, and the sun is at its highest point at midday. So to say what I just said three times is not the right way to say it. But if you make the comparison, then perhaps it's a little clearer. What light through yonder window breaks? It is the east, and Juliet is the sun. And then we have this understanding of the tension between little light and big light, and she is the big light. That's the meaning of that line.
It's interesting how the performer is almost discovering the words at the same time as the audience is, if it's done correctly.
That's right. If it's done correctly, and of course the actor's been rehearsing for three, four weeks, but yes, it should look like he's just discovered, or she's just finding out the words.
How does iambic pentameter help or hinder a performance? Is it a cell that it's trapped in, or is it a release valve?
Thank you for that question. iambic pentameter, I tell my class, is just as spoken as much of as the show that I'm not allowed to say.
Right. But it rhymes with car wreck.
Yeah. iambic pentameter is one of the worst things that ever happened to the study of Shakespeare, in my humble opinion. Sometimes Shakespeare does indeed write in iambic pentameter. 60% of the time, he writes in iambic pentameter. 40% of the time, and that's, I'm just talking about the verse, not the prose. Yeah. He doesn't. Most high school and college teachers, when they teach Shakespeare to people, stress the iambic pentameter. It's there. There's no doubt about it. It's there. But then they forget about everything else.
Right.
And so, to me, the expression iambic pentameter is anathema, because it gets in the way of the true understanding of what's being
Good.
Said.
Because that's what happened to me in high school.
Yeah, you tripped over the iambic pentameter?
I did.
Yeah. That was crazy.
Shakespeare himself calls it the lame, what was the line? The
lame.
The lame.
No. Do you know? No, I don't.
Never mind. I can't remember. Go ahead.
It'll come.
What was the gateway drug for you with Shakespeare when you first discovered it? And for someone who has found it potentially dense and hasn't embraced Shakespeare yet, do you have something that you would recommend other than your class, you know, whether it's a movie or a book that they could use that as? I mean, I remember seeing Macbeth in second grade, and that was like, for me, what was got me hooked on Shakespeare. But do you, you know, what was it for you, and what would you recommend to someone who wants to embrace Shakespeare but hasn't yet?
Okay. I think the thing that got me hooked, I'm old enough to have been in the audience for Zeffirelli's Romeo and Juliet. I think that was the hook. I think watching those people be so beautiful constantly, they were beautiful people to begin with, but what they were saying was gorgeous. So that's the hook. That's pretty much what did it. The next thing, and I want to, this is a good place to talk about this. The next thing was I had a teacher in college. His name was David Rhodes. And he instilled in me the love of the language that that was the start of my dedicating my life. There isn't a day go by that I don't, maybe today I didn't do it, but it do something about the study of Shakespeare. Now, I want to tell this story so we can use up our time. So,
you have to be somewhere?
Okay. So David Rhodes, I want to bring this name up. David Rhodes was my Shakespeare professor at UCLA. I can say that, yeah, UCLA. Now, what's special about David Rhodes, besides being my teacher? I think he came from very rich Texas oil money, I think. All I know was after I graduated, he used to bring in all these young English actors into UCLA to help him with the teaching of Shakespeare. And they used to do some sort of performance. I'm not quite sure what it was, but did some sort of performance. And one of these performances was a older gentleman who was a producer on a show that Patrick Stewart did. And he went to the seminar and he saw a young Patrick Stewart performing Shakespeare in the classroom. And he went back to Roddenberry, I can say that. He went back to Roddenberry and said, "I think I found the captain." And that, my friends, is how Sir Patrick Stewart got that job.
What job was that?
And being in the Writers Guild and having less restrictive things, that was Bob Justman, right? On Star Trek. Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Yeah.
And yeah, Bob Justman doesn't get the credit that he deserves often, and he does because he was such a vital part of the DNA of Star Trek. So, go ahead.
So, you know, I was just going to say that it's so interesting kind of listening to you talk about this and your gateway drug. You know, for me, it was Kenneth Branagh's Henry V.
Yeah, great
that
film.
That was the first time I realized that Shakespeare was not boring, and it was not forced on me, and it had, you know, blood in its veins, and it was amazing. And then, you know, cut to 20 years later, I'm working on Thor with Kenneth Branagh. And we're literally, you know, we're just sitting in a conference room, and, You know, the man is, he's in jeans and a t-shirt, and he's wearing Converse shoes, and he's got his feet kicked up. And he's just talking about how, you know, he's been thinking about, you know, Hamlet's monologue from Act Three for 30 years and how he's been trying to figure it out. And he says, you know, it's, I think it's in, you know, Hamlet's speech to Horatio after Laertes visits him and says, you're kind of a dick. And like you made my sister crazy and she's dead now and you killed my dad and I hate you and I'm going to kill you in front of everybody. And he starts giving that speech, except he didn't recite it. He didn't perform it. He just looked at me and I was Horatio and he was Hamlet and he gave the speech. And at the end of it, I burst into tears like a child. I needed a hug. Kevin Feige gave me one. It was fine. But, you know, what really stuck with me about that was just the sheer amount of preparation that must go into a role like that, beyond like the things I think that we're even, you know, talking about now. I mean, obviously there's breaking down the words and the meanings of the words, and there's, you know, going through your Riverside and, you know, and trying to figure out what all the context is.
Don't use Riverside.
Is there a better annotated
version? Oh, much better.
Send me some resources. But, you know, going through like the sort of the history and the context and all those things. But even if you're doing, say, for example, a science fiction show that nobody here has seen and we're not going to talk about, how is the preparation different for you between, you know, when you're talking about something like, you know, look, you teach Shakespeare, you interact with this text, you know, on a daily basis for all intents and purposes. You know, you have these long conversations about it with your students. When you work on a show or a film, regardless of what it is, and we don't have to say what, you know, how do you kind of pack in that preparation? How does that change your approach when it's not kind of woven into the fabric of your everyday?
I don't know.
Oh, it means I win.
You won. Because it is woven into me every day, so I don't know. I think what you should do is find films like that, the brand of Henry V, Zeffirelli, Romeo and Juliet. Watch those performances, emulate them. I'll tell you, I was going to do a Shakespearean role that Sir Patrick was famous for, and I called him up and said, you've done this role three times, any suggestions? So you call up other people who've done it and say, do you have any suggestions? You don't go to a Riverside. you just keep thinking about it. And this is what we do for every role. It's not just Shakespearean roles. Certainly Shakespearean roles other people have done, and you can consult with them. But for every role, you dig deep. You try to find out what's there. What's there besides the words? What's the situation? What's the intention? What is it that I want? What is it? What am I going to win in this scene? Am I going to lose in this scene? And then, of course, when you meet the other actors, that brings in a whole other palette of colors. So, but you dig. You keep digging. You keep working. And if you're lucky, if you're doing a recurring character on a show, you learn from what you did in the first episode to the second episode. How do I make this better? What am I not getting right here? Ah, now I understand where that character's coming from. None of us start out in any pilot episode perfect. We have to learn. We have to learn not only about our own characters, but the other characters, and probably more importantly, where is this show going and how do I fit into that puzzle? So you do that for Shakespeare as well.
Yeah. I want to ask you, checking the last box of Armin is a Renaissance Man, you're also an author. Can you tell us sort of what that did for you, that the creative instinct that drove you to write, and what surprised you about writing novels?
So originally, when I was a very young man, preteen, I thought that's what I was going to do. I thought I was going to be a writer. And then I was seduced by the dark side of the force.
It's okay. You didn't work on that.
I didn't. Actually, I did. But that's a secret.
Well, then we can't talk about it.
So I've forgotten the question.
Your books.
My books. Oh, yeah. My books. I started writing my books while I was in the trailer, and because I was bored and there was nothing to do and there was nothing on TV. And I remembered my aspirations as a young man. And I wanted to write something that I knew about. I know something about Shakespeare and his world. I've studied it long enough. I think I know something. Not as much as others, probably more than some others. So, and my friend Michael Scott had once put an idea in my head, which I had slightly forgotten about, but it was always there. And that was to relate Elizabethan history with one of the plays that Shakespeare wrote. The play that I chose for my novels and the three novels that I've just completed, which is the Illyria series, and because from the title, some of you may know that that's related to Twelfth Night. So what it taught me was to really examine language, which is what great authors do, whether they write for plays or novels or TV or film. When authors use delicious language, language that can either be erudite or just so normal sounding. That other show that I did where I played a principal.
That rhymes with Tuffy. Yeah,
that's the one. I was amazed at the linguistic facility that the writers had on that show, that they created language that I had never heard before and fell in love with. You know, I didn't know what my bad meant when I first read it. And now I use it every other day.
Except during the strike.
Yeah, yeah. And so I love, what I learned was to be more nimble, more adept at using language correctly as a writer. I don't do it as a speaker, but I can do it as a writer, because we can always go back and change it, blot it out, find another word. And that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking for writers now, but I think the craft of writing is rewriting. That's what you do. Sure. You rewrite and you rewrite and you rewrite until you get it as close to perfect as you can. That's what I learned from writing.
Now, your main character in those books, as I understand it, is John Dee.
John Dee, Dr. So, John Dee, yeah.
So, you know, tell us, what is the coolest thing about John Dee and why he justifies three books?
Well, John Dee was considered to be a magician. He was indeed a Renaissance man. He was a great mathematician. He was a great scientist. He helped, I can never remember which, he helped towards the discovery of latitude or longitude, one of those two, I can't remember. And he taught a lot of the aristocrats of that time math and language and other things. The queen thought he was most important because he was also an astrologer as well as an astronomer. But as an astrologer, she asked him for the most propitious day that she should become queen. And he decided, I think I have this right, he decided November the 16th. I think that's right. And and she lived a very long time. And she attributed the fact that she had such a long life when a lot of people were trying to kill her. She attributed her long life and her long reign to the fact that her astrologer, John Dee, gave her that coronation date. But he did many things. And one of the things that I discovered while I was researching the novel, put your two questions together, was there a lot of scholars believe that Shakespeare only came up with the plot for one play. Everything else he ripped off. It's a good Ferengi.
What's that?
I can say that. Because they appear in many shows. So the scholars are always looking for which piece of material was the original idea for the plot for each of these plays. One scholar in particular was saying that Richard II, who came before Richard III,
that was the one with Khan.
Perhaps the template for that plot came from a French poem called Trezon. And then in the footnote at the bottom of the page, as I was reading that article, it said, but the only person, oh, and John Dee had the largest library in England. There was, he had far and away more books than anybody else. And the footnote said that the only person who had a copy of Trezon, that template, was John Dee, which means that Shakespeare must have gotten to Dee's library, which is what my books are about. So,
awesome. Hearing you talk about Shakespeare, it reminds me of fandom, because there is a very specific group of people who are, quote, fans of Shakespeare. There are fans of Sherlock Holmes. There are fans of TV shows that we can't talk about. But something that is incredibly interesting to me is hearing learned fans talk about these things as we do about these other things. Specifically, there is a bit on YouTube where it has Orson Welles, Peter O'Toole, and Michael McLare talking about Hamlet. And they spend about an hour talking about bits and pieces of the play as, you know, learned. They've all performed various parts in it. And it's so fascinating to see their interest and their lifelong devotion to this. And it's really inspiring.
I think you're right. I never thought of it that way, but I think you're absolutely right. We're all fans. That's what we are. We're fans, and we take it apart the same way people take apart episodes. You
and know? We're all trying to be better at knowing these subjects that we love.
Exactly. Maybe some of you, from what we're talking about here, will go out and, you know, get a movie and take a look, or even better, pick up a play. You're bound to find a play somewhere, and just start to read it. But don't use a Riverside. Use the Arden edition. Use the Arden edition.
And if you want to get chocolate in your peanut butter, like Darren was suggesting, one of the great stories, of course, is Nick Meyer, who's a huge fan of Sherlock Holmes and Shakespeare. The reason he cast Christopher Plummer in that Star Trek movie was so he could hear Christopher Plummer recite Shakespeare all day long,
which he did.
Why there's...
I will now tell you a Christopher Plummer story. So I had the good fortune, or bad fortune, depending how you look at it, to work with Christopher Plummer in Henry V, where he played a very old Henry V. And I was playing actually French ambassador, and Henry has a very famous speech. It's called the tennis ball speech, which is brilliantly written. And it was just me and Chris on stage, and he had this big speech to make. At that time, I'm 30, maybe 31. I don't know, young to me now. Anyway, he was doing this tennis ball speech to me, and we did it 8 times a week. He did it 8 times a week. I listened 8 times a week. And one performance, Christopher Plummer is a brilliant Shakespearean actor. When I worked with him, he was not a brilliant human being. He was a little hard to work, but he was brilliant at Shakespeare. There was no doubt about that. And he was doing the speech, and he went up, couldn't remember the line. And he was looking at me, and his hand started to rise like this. He's staring at me, begging me to help him out of this situation. And it got to be about here, and I had heard the speech enough so that I threw him a word, which brought him back. Now, did he thank me? No. Did he acknowledge that had happened? No. No. So a little later in the summer, same place, same speech, different word. The hand started to come up, staring at me, looking for the help that I'd given him before. Got to about here, which is where I helped him before. Nothing from me. Got to about here, and as Avery Brooks said about me once, you're too dutiful, yes? I gave him the word, because it's a theater. You're supposed to help people out in the theater.
Sure.
So I gave him the word when he got to about here.
Plastics.
Like all stories, there's the third act to this. And on another day, no answer here. No prompt here. It was a hell of his own making. He should get out of it.
We only have a few minutes left, and I think I would be remiss if I didn't. A lot of people are saying, we hear a lot about these strikes, about the actors' strike.
Oh, good, good, good. Yeah.
And I think it's really important because they go, you can't talk about these things.
Yeah,
this all
good,
about?
Mark.
So
yeah.
I'd love it if you could articulate what's at stake right now for actors, and we're happy to jump on with the Writers Guild, but more for actors because, you know, nobody cares about the writers.
But they do, because you can't have anything, as I said before, there is nothing, or if I haven't said it, I should say it, there is nothing without writers. We are the interpretive artists. We are not the creative artists.
Well,
we
always have Shakespeare. You always have Shakespeare there.
Say again?
You always have Shakespeare.
Shakespeare,
there.
Yeah. But he was an actor and a writer, so... but yes, important to explain why we can't say what the names of the shows. Let me, among my many hats, and I have worn many, at one time I was a high official in the union, in the Screen Actors Guild. Thank you. In fact, while I was doing that show that I can't talk about, I was also a national board member. And in fact, I think it was 99 or 2001, I can't remember, but I was actually the chair of the negotiating committee that is in the midst of this strike. So, why are the actors and the writers on strike? Basically, it's because the way TV is made, not made, but the way it's delivered is changing, and also the way it's made for the writers as well. So, the streaming business has come in where an audience can watch 10, 12 episodes of a show over the course of a few days or a week or so, And you don't have to wait a week to see the next episode of your favorite show. That is changing the way people are getting paid and the way they're getting hired. For the writers, I'll start with the writers, and you can talk about this better than I. They get hired for a period of time to, say, create a show. And what usually happens is they get paid up front, and they get no more money. Am I right about this? You get very little or no money at all after you get your original check.
It law of diminishing returns.
Okay, so it gets less and less. But certainly from what my good friend Ira Bear told me, what was that there's sort of an indicated period of time that you have to do that in. Am I right about that?
Yeah.
And then what happens now with the streaming is that time gets doubled or possibly tripled so that you hired on for... I'm going to make this number up. They can do it better than I can. They're hired for like 3 months, 4 months to do something. Then it becomes 8 months, becomes 12 months. And that original major chunk of money is now much less because it's taken that much longer to do. And the mini rooms where on the show that most of the shows that I did had
22, 26, yep. Theoretically.
Right, 26 episodes. Now you're doing 13. So what does that mean?
It means...
Or six.
Or eight.
Yeah. What does that mean? It means that, now putting the writers aside, it means that, okay, the series regulars probably got very good money to be series regulars. But what about the supporting cast? What about the extras? What about the everybody else? Instead of having 26, 22 episodes to work on, now they have 12, 10. And if you're connected as a series regular to a show, then you pretty much say, I can't do any other show, except for me. I got away with murder. but most times they get said, okay, you can't do, there's no exclusivity. So I have friends who were on that other show that Patrick was on that just recently aired. So I have friends who were on that show and they did 3 seasons. Except they were hired for 5 years, but only got paid for 3 seasons. Yeah. But they were hired for 5 years and could not do any other show. That is wrong, in my opinion. Now, also, because of AI, and we're striking over this as well, artificial intelligence, the offer that was made to the background players, which are enormously essential to a show, you may not think they're necessary, but they are. What the producers offered was, we want to be able to to have a background person come onto the set. We'll shoot him on the camera. We'll pay him $100 or so. That's what they get. It's a minimal amount of money. And we will own that person's image for perpetuity. And we can use it anytime we want, and we don't have to ever consult you again. Now, that's the background. Now let's talk about the voiceover actors, which I am a part of. It shouldn't take very long for AI to eradicate that field altogether. Because once you've heard me do Nefarious, for instance, you can replicate that voice any way you'd like. And you won't need Mr. Shimmerman to do that voice anymore. I've just lost out on that salary. The background people had just lost out on that salary. If there's no background people, then probably 5, 6, 7, 8 makeup artists are now just put out of work because they don't have anybody to make up, because those people have to be made up too. The people who do voiceovers for commercials will be eradicated. The stunts may not need stunt people to do that anymore. People who risk their lives to do TV and film, they can be eliminated. Just take their picture and stick them in any way they like. This is what we're fighting for. And the writers have slightly different things that they're working for. Also, as far as salaries, you have to understand, I'm standing up here in front of you as a celebrity. But the truth is, I'm a working Joe. I'm only slightly above most actors. In our union, there's 160,000 members. They say 1% makes a very good percentage, but I don't think that's true, because 1% of 160,000 is 1,600. I don't think there's 1,600 major actors. I just don't. So how we get paid is in salary and in residuals. And in streaming, the residuals have pretty much been taken away. So they get no money. So talking again about my friend who
has... You've gotten 1 cent checks before, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've gotten several. I got them framed, actually. it is an impossible situation. So why are we not saying the names? Let's answer that question. The reason why my union has asked us not to do this is to not publicize product that belongs to the producers and the studios and the networks. If we mention the names, then the union feels we are promoting that work. If I talk about the work I did in science fiction, you may indeed say, well, I want to go out and see that show, and then you buy that product and they get money. So we are striking in many ways, and one of the ways is not to publicize the product that we did. Furthermore, it's a credit. I will mention two names. It's a credit to Michelle Hurd, and you know which show she was on, and to Sean Astin, who were on the present negotiating committee, who carved out the ability for me to appear here today. Because my union, for the most part, knows nothing about conventions. But those two actors do. And they said, all of the actors are going to suffer from the strike, except for the ones that, you know, do interactive games and cartoons. Those contracts were not striking. When they say the actors are on strike, we're only on strike against the TV and film contract. We have several contracts. But our union doesn't understand the convention circuit. And thankfully, those two actors do. And they said, we can appear under certain prohibitions. And one is what you're seeing. All of the actors have no product connected to their names. It's just our names. It doesn't say what we appeared on. And that's in obeying what the union has spelled out to the convention so that we can appear. So as much as that's a hindrance for some people, it allows us to be here. It allows all the actors that whose tables you're going to visit, all the writers that you're going to visit, a chance to make some money while they're on strike, and at the same time, be here for you if you want us.
Thank you for articulating that so well. And thank you for being here. It meant a lot to everyone. They've asked me to say there's a giant group selfie that's going to be taken here at the stage. So come on up, take a giant selfie with Armin, apparently. And we'll be running a promo for Trexperts at the same time.
Thank you all, everybody. For being here. Armin
will be at I feel bad, guys, because that was a great interview. He had a great time. He loved it. He was at the booth next to us signing. And, you know, as we did, we said, oh, Armin, you know, you should join us for dinner. He said, I would love to. Be great. And like the first night,
the main course.
He couldn't.
Sorry.
They took him back to his hotel and couldn't figure out how to get to the restaurant. And then the next day we invited him, but he'd fallen asleep and didn't get the message till the morning. I was like, then we invited him the next night, but he wasn't going to be there. He was already leaving. I was like, it was always the bridesmaid, never the bride.
Oh, that these two solid plans would melt.
Oh boy. my only regret about that, that panel, honestly, is that we were, when he got up and did his impromptu Richard III, that we were sitting behind him.
Right. We didn't get to see it.
Yeah, we didn't get to see it. I mean, it was, and look, people, you don't really get to see it either. You only get to hear it. But he stood up, he hunched his back.
Full Richard III physicality.
That's so great that you pointed that out, because that does not come across in the audio version.
No, not a bit.
He physicalized. That's why I made the joke about
the character.
Superman. He turned away from the audience. You couldn't see him. You know, he physically transformed on stage into Richard III. And humpback.
And hopefully it recorded okay, because, you know, they didn't set up the microphone.
Didn't bring the mic in until a little bit into the performance, but
he was projecting, so that was good.
It was great.
Yeah, it's funny. I wish we, you know, had more time to talk to him about all that stuff. I went and I checked out the art in Shakespeare, and I get like why an actor loves that. It's very geared towards actors, because it has the play, and then it has all the end notes, the footnotes that are basically sitting on that next page, and you can tell, you know, who is supposed to be saying what. It's not an addition that's written for somebody who isn't trying to perform the play. But that was just like one of my favorite things. I mean, I think we probably could have sat there and had a whole other 1 hour conversation with him about that. But sadly, absolutely, we only had an hour on stage.
Look, I would love to have, I think it was 45 minutes to be honest, but I'm looking forward to having Armin back. I'm looking forward to having Armin back when he can talk about Star Trek. And I know he's looking forward to joining us as well. But it was a great panel. We had a great time. As always, Mike Broder and his team made us feel extremely welcome, showed us a great time, always a great time at GalaxyCon. And if you're anywhere near Austin, Texas, I hope you'll join us September 1st through the 3rd at GalaxyCon in Austin, where we'll be hosting several panels and visiting, welcoming people to our booth, the Inglourious Treksprits booth, along with many great Star Trek stars and others who will be attending that weekend.
Wonderful meals, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. You get to hear all about them.
Oh my God, boys. We're gonna eat like kings in Austin. Our restaurant review episode is gonna be fabulous.
A thing of beauty. Oh,
just as long as we don't get a horse for our kingdom.
Yeah.
And we want to remind you that our Kickstarter is still going on. You can support us at makethetrek.com to help us make the ultimate Trek journey, the ultimate Trek road trek, by supporting our Kickstarter, which will feature the Treksprits joined by many great Trek stars, some of which have already been announced, like Terry Farrell and Star Trek V Cynthia Gao. Many more have been announced since then, who'll be joining us as we make the trek. So please come along. Some fabulous backer awards are available when you check our Kickstarter page. And we hope you'll support this endeavor to celebrate the 60th anniversary. But it was a great time at GalaxyCon, wasn't it, guys?
Loved it.
Oh, it was amazing, as always.
Yeah.
Can't wait to get back there.
Great show. Great show. They really know how to put on a good show. And I can't say that about every convention, but GalaxyCon sure does it right.
And they treat us right.
They do indeed. And if you want to treat us right, you want to subscribe to Treksprits Plus, where you can get a subscription to our subscriber-only podcast, Deck 78, available on Spotify on the Inglourious Treksprits feed as a subscriber-only podcast. So subscribe today at Treksprits Plus. Or you can follow us on social at Inglourious Trek or Inglourious Treksprits, wherever you tweet, X, or Thread. And that's about it for us. Anything else, guys?
I think we've got.
No, I was just wondering, what do you call it on Blue Sky? Do you blow sky? It's like, I don't know.
I'm not on Blue Sky, so I don't know.
Me neither. I don't know anybody.
I can't do any more of these freaking social things. I'm so over it.
I want to have anti-social media. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, that's what I call this podcast.
Yeah.
My whole life is anti-social media. But anyway, thanks for joining us for another great episode of Inglourious Trekspits. We'll be back next Thursday with an all-new episode as the countdown to my departure, or a countdown to Detonation, continues. And on behalf of Ashley Edward Miller, Darren Doctor, myself, Mark A. Altman, keep on trekking ingloriously, of course.